Welcome, everyone, to a music and technology podcast. It's actually called Rack Addicts After Hours. This is episode 83. I hope we're welcoming you back. If you're a new listener, welcome. We've got three people. First voice you've heard is Ben. We've got Luke and Pete today. Lots of synthy news, some spacey bits, some sci-fi media stuff to discuss as well. But I hope you're happy to join us. We start with a weekly roundup, of course. Who wants to go first? Luke, I'm picking on you. What have you been up to?
I spent a lot of hours playing, probably one of my favourite video games of all time is Kerbal Space Program.
It's ascended the all-time list.
Mm. Ooh. My Steam hours count is getting into the embarrassing sector, yes.
Give us a number.
I don't know. I dread to think.
I'm just glad I don't know how many hours I spent on Minecraft. Mm. That would be bad.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those kinds of games as well. You have to make your own fun. Mm. And if you get into the habit of that, then you're just gone. Yeah, I've definitely gone, I'll just play another half hour. It's 2 a.m.
Yep. Anyway, KSP, for those who don't know, what is it?
It is a spacecraft assembly and flight simulator game, which makes it sound exactly as boring as that sounds. But it's wonderful. You play as these charming little green men on this little planet called Kerbal. You are in charge of their space program at the Kerbal Space Center, which is obviously a Cape Canaveral throwback type thing there. And you essentially have to build spacecraft out of the parts that they give you. You can play in various formats. You can play in career mode, where you have to do strict missions. You can play replica missions of real life space missions, or you can just go in sandbox, or you can go into what my favorite mode, which is science sandbox, where you don't have to worry about all the money and missions and replica and bloody blah, but you do level up as you do more things, so it's a bit more fun and easy, and also just there's no pressure.
But you could still pick a target, like do the classic moon landing or something.
Yeah, if you want to. Or you can do Moonbase Alpha and send, you know, an entire building to the moon just because you've got Delta V for it. It's fine. Which is what I was doing today before I had to come to the podcast. I was showing my friends online. We stream our games sometimes, and I like to entertain them because I'm not very good at KSP, despite the fact that I play it all the time. And so I hadn't really done any math. I said, look, I'm going to send this massive castle of a space station to land on the moon. Watch me do it. And of course, it plummeted. And, you know, all of my brave Kerbals have ascended to heroes.
MIA.
Yes, they are heroes of the Kerbal Nation.
I'm just imagining kind of a house with many boosters attached to it and nothing else.
Oh, it was great. I put a lot of time into building it, but it is moon dust now. We'll try again later.
Nice one.
But yeah, that's kind of been me. I've just been fiddling with that.
Lots of KSP. Sounds good. Pete, what about you? You showed me some modulary bits.
Yes, I've been on a bit of an economy drive.
Indeed. Tell us more.
I was definitely contemplating either a monsoon or a cloud or something of that ilk, either one of the clones or what would you describe them as? Like clones? They're sort of
riffs. Alternative versions, that'll do.
Anyway, so I was contemplating one of those, couldn't make up my mind, and the same with rings or, again, a clone or a tribute or whatever.
The real deal.
And it occurred to me the easiest thing to do initially was just to buy some black faceplates for the rings
for your precious colour scheme
that I've got already. So that's what I did, and it was substantially less money than buying modules, but got me there quicker, at least for now. I spent the grand total of something like £7, I think.
How budget-friendly of you.
For two faceplates.
Nice one. Is that just one rings, one clouds?
Yes.
Or two clouds?
That was another purchase as well.
Spoilers.
So while I was on the website, I bought another faceplate for clouds and a clouds circuit board, but with no component. That's something further down
Project
the road.
Project for the future, or an excuse to get a reflow oven.
Yes, possibly. So that kind of worked, but that's kind of accelerated. I received the M185 sequencer.
Ah, yes, from last episode.
Yes, and I've got to construct that. So apart from maybe a 2HP Verb.
Ooh, classic.
And maybe the DivKid, the Oct.
Yes.
The phasing LFO thingy.
Mm, yeah.
Other than those two items, I think I might almost be there.
Surprisingly short amount of time. You just got to make your case.
Yes. So I'm all up together. So I nearly did it today. I've got to go out and buy a nail gun.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing great. A small one that fires.
Like an electric one.
Yes, an electric one. What I'm going to do is construct a plywood case.
Yeah, don't go for that heavy stuff.
Yeah, reasonably thin. I don't know, what, 9mm maybe?
Yeah.
So a plywood case that's glued and pinned, and then I'll cover it in vinyl. And that,
nice.
Maybe I'll do something later on, but I just need to get the case put together.
Yeah. You're going to add some of those, flight case style metal cornery bits.
There's quite a few places where you can order that type of thing. So, yeah, the sort of protective corners, the butterfly catches or just the little flicky catches and the hinges that you can slide, you can detachable hinges.
Yeah, yeah, nice one. What are you doing for power?
I've got an internal power supply. So that was one from Clicks and Clocks, which is one of the reproductions of the original Dofer power supply that was in the 9U inexpensive case.
The one before they went for a switching power supply.
Yeah, the one with the big massive toroidal transformer on it.
Akira was teaching me about those the other day.
I've got one of those. Then I'll have an external IRC socket built in the side so we can just plug a kettle lead straight into it.
Nice.
You're away. So no trailing power packs or anything like that. I can't stand all that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I should be good to go. I'm sort of trying to get into an accelerated mode, especially when there was the threat of the modular CAF happening.
Yeah, maybe not the one coming up soon, but maybe the one after.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be panicked into something. As I always say, I don't want it to be rubbish, anything that I do as a performance. And I'm still kind of perfecting my tweakings with the current set of modules.
Yeah, we do need to get some people to volunteer for live sets or demonstrations for that one.
Have you got any volunteers so far for this?
Nil.
No one's,
at the moment, it's an empty program, so we need to fix that before the 4th.
No one's prepared to submit themselves for the first event in 18 months.
Yeah, I'm sure we can get somebody to do something. If not, I'll have to try and master Plinky and show everybody that. We'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm sure you don't mind getting stuck into that sort of thing.
No, not too much. It'd give me a good excuse. I do want to test out the sampler that's in there as well.
Okay.
Maybe sample the old Yamaha piano we have. Shimmer reverb as well, so that always makes things easy.
Okay.
Nice one. Well, from my week, kittens are here, but other than that, I think it's time to jump up on some synth news. Erica Synth, time first. This one's really cool. If you remember, I think it was called the Syntrax. Yeah, they did that sort of not copy, but an honourable nod to the old Synthy A, not the VCS3. I always get them confused. Do you remember that one? Or am I just talking words and you can't remember the synth I mean, Pete?
Shortly, I don't know what it's called, is it? The synth is the sort of suitcasey one, isn't it?
Is it the suitcasey one, not the lab equipment style one?
The lab equipment style one, it's definitely got a joystick in it, but I can't remember if it's got a...
I think they both do. I'm pretty sure it's a Synthy A. They do. I think it's a Synthy A. Anyway, we'll move on from that. Erica Synth made a modern reimagining, and it had a digital pin matrix style mixer patch bay thing that could do presets. This has now been externalized and desktopified. That's desktopified, the technical term, of course. And it's super cool. So you've got 16 in and outs. These are DC coupled. And like I said, it's a digital pin matrix. So each patch point that you can make has 3 levels of attenuation. So you can almost completely, you know, save a modular patch, which is not something we've had the ability to do before. For the privilege, you will be paying €490, but I can see this being quite desirable for certain workflows, I think. Because presets, you have lots of presets, which I believe you can MIDI address as well.
So how do you recall them? Just by punching in the buttons on the matrix?
You have a couple of encoders, and I assume they'll be, yeah, I can see it there on the picture, a recall button, and you can just scroll through. I assume because you've got 16 by 16, you'll have the maths number of that many presets, one would assume. 254, I didn't do that in my head. It's written down on my notes in front of me. But yeah, that'll be how you just grab your presets. A little tricky to remember what's where, I imagine, although Matrix Brute owners will probably have the same issue.
But these buttons look way smaller than the ones on the Matrix.
Well, they're not buttons. You'll just scroll.
You scroll to get the appropriate LED. So these are LEDs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That could still be quite awkward.
It can be.
Or is it like Etch-a-Sketch or something?
I think it is Etch-a-Sketch style, actually, which seems fine, but still, yeah, remembering where everything is in that dense grid of... Either way, I think it's a really cool idea. Future Sound Systems has a desktop pin matrix, which is, I think it might be 4x4, designed to have lots of pedals connected up to your synth, so you can really quickly kind of patch things out without having to do sort of the patch bay thing, and it has a drive circuit and a few other bits in there. This is an expansion of that kind of idea. Yeah, I think it's available pretty soon. It's a cool option.
The fact it's desktop is a bit strange in some respects.
I think given the amount of space you'd need for the jacks and the LED matrix, I think it would just be such an unwieldy, wide Eurorack yes. module. That's probably why they've done it. And of course, you can. It looks like you can interface with quarter-inch stuff because it's got jacks on the sides as well.
So it's meant to be kind of universal.
Mostly Eurorack patch saving, but then still some implementation as well.
It doesn't do anything other than form connections.
Pretty much. There's three levels, arbitrary levels of attenuation that you can set per connection as well. So let's say on your left you had some LFOs and envelopes and stuff, and you had destinations along the top. You could mix and match that way. So it would have to change how you patch things. Think of it as just a really, really flexible CV mixer and router.
Pretty handy if you've got lots of kit, but if
it's not that useful in a small system.
I reckon. That's what I was thinking. If it's fine for someone who's got ridiculous amounts of modular or something like that, or a cross between semi-modular, modular, and a variety of other things. A considerable amount of synths are coming with CV in them these days as well, aren't they?
Definitely. And what I'm thinking of now, you mentioned the sizable amount of modular. If you had it with your Moth, you would then also need very long patch cables if you wanted to put it somewhere convenient, and then you'd have to deal with the spaghetti as well.
Yes.
Unless you sort of ran them all along the same kind of direction, then again, they just need to be really long.
It's fine if you don't need to be flexible. If you're forever repatching, it'd be a nightmare.
Yeah. Either way, it's a cool idea. It's there if you need it. Erica Synth's Desktop Matrix Mixer.
Be interesting to see someone actually using one.
Yeah, definitely. So I have actually got a bunch more synth news to jump through that isn't on the pre-programmed order of events. So I'm going to take you guys by surprise. Firstly, one that we've mentioned before. Do you remember the Soma Labs Cosmos, the looping effects pedal desktop thing?
Yes, and I watched the video.
So did I. What do you reckon?
I didn't get excited, put it
you
that
didn't?
Way.
Oh, no, interesting.
I mean, it was interesting, but I didn't light any fires under me.
Okay, I quite liked it. It grabbed me more than I expected it would, given our overview last time.
My concern is, is it going to be turn out to be a sort of one-trick pony?
Potentially. They are potentially doing alternate firmwares for it. So it can be flexible because it's a digital thing, but we'll have to see.
Bit of a departure for them going digital like this.
Yeah, it's a different kind of device. Though, did I tell you about that binaural noise source for meditation that they make?
I think you did mention it.
Almost. We have a fly in the studio. Luke almost got it. Ah, they're too fast. But yeah, I mean, there is another Soma Labs bit of news, which I'll take you through next. That was just more of a check out LoopOps demo, because that'll let you know if you want it or not.
Yes, it's certainly worth a watch, the video, but I didn't feel that I had to rush to the Soma Labs website and place an order.
Nah. I don't think I would, even if I could.
It didn't give you gas in that sense.
No, not at all.
That's fair
enough. Not an instant gas fire. Okay, more normal Soma Labs form. We have a proper announcement, demo, and pictures of Enner, that's E-N-N-E-R, which I think we've briefly mentioned because they were talking about a polysynth with strange hands-on control. We now know what it looks like. Let me show you a picture, chaps. This is potentially a seven-voice synth-ish with some filters, some stereo delays.
My. What is that?
Exactly. So, listeners, open up a browser. Soma Labs Enner. E-N-N-E-R. I like Soma Labs. I think they make very interesting synthesizers. This looks absolutely awful.
What is it exactly? What is the instrument?
Okay, so you've got some bits in there that you can use to do stuff. You have a field of stereo filters. I don't know what a field of stereo filters means. A modulated stereo delay. That's kind of, that makes sense. Oh, wait, I think I said seven. Five voice synthesizer with tune control per voice. There is also another synthesizer in there for rhythmical click spaces and octave tones, a built-in piezo pickup, noise pad outputs, and an external in. And the main interface is this, I'm sorry, Soma Labs, shoddy-looking, hand-etched PCB main plate with these touch pads that you poke around. It's got a spring kind of slapped haphazardly on there.
Is that actually it, or is that a prototype?
That's it.
Okay. Oh.
So the prototype looked even worse, if you can imagine. I don't think it sounds interesting. I think it looks awful. Why?
Oh, gosh.
Fight me, people. What? I don't get it.
I can dig the organic aesthetic they're going for there. Personally, I don't. I'm a sci-fi nerd, as I'm sure you've worked out by now. But I can appreciate the sort of bio thing they've got going on there.
They were setting out to make something really tactile and human interaction focused outside of a normal chromatic keyboard. But at least they could have made it look more appealing. What I do appreciate is that there are very few labels on it. The ones that are there do appear to be in a very handwritten Russian cursive, so you've got no idea what they are. And I appreciate the obfuscation of the use of the thing, but there is a hand-drawn map of the thing that looks like a child drew it that might be the user manual. You might be able to tell, I'm not on board. What, €440 on that? No, thank you.
Be interesting to see if anyone stocks it.
Or anybody actually uses it properly.
It might be one of those things that sells so well because it's an ugly duckling, you know? Because we've had that before. I mean, that's kind of what... Who is it that makes the OP1?
Teenage Engineering.
That's what Teenage, you know, thrive on. I mean, admittedly, their style is not that kind of
hand-drawn
wooden thing.
No, it's more of an Apple clean sometimes.
Yeah, but also kind of deconstructed, missing bits, you know.
Pocket operators look really... Yeah. Raw, I suppose.
Rugged, yeah.
Anyway, I've slagged off the Enna enough. Watch the video, see what you reckon. Yeah.
Is there any videos with it making noises?
Yeah, there's quite a few demos around.
How does it actually sound?
There are elements of the Lyra in there, as in there's a lot of noise.
Okay. So it's essentially it's analog.
Oh, yeah, I believe so.
Okay. Well, at least it's more in their tradition.
Yeah. It's very Soma, and I don't have any time for it. Let's move on, shall we? Here's one. This is a Eurorack module made by a brand that has one of my favourite names, not one I knew of. I think they're new. They are Nobula.
Okay.
K-N-O-B-U-L-A. Nobula. I think this is a kickstarted thing, and I think all of their pre-sale ones are now sold out. This is called the Poly Cinematic. This is a 12 HP module, which is an 8-voice polyphonic synthesizer with 56 oscillators, a chord mode, detuning stuff, multiple waveforms, filter, reverb, and envelope, and it's stereo, all in one quite big module. The only demo that I've found, it sounds fine, but yeah, that's kind of cool. It's an interesting concept, it's always been that thing, you know, chords in modular can be expensive and massive, or just kind of a blag, to be honest. This is really cool. It's got a TRS MIDI input, so you could control it pretty easily.
Neat. So it's a complete thing. It's a complete voice rather than being just an oscillator.
Exactly. So what was that really expensive one that you sort of looked over because it was super expensive when you were looking at the chainsaw?
It was the
Demon Core.
Demon Core, yeah.
So that would just be an oscillator. This, in the same footprint, pretty much, is everything. Like I said, it's got a reverb in it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, because if you go for one of these expensive oscillator types, you still need envelopes and all the rest of it to make it sound proper.
Yeah, so should be available in September, apparently, though I think this will be gutted by the semiconductor shortage.
Was it on Kickstarter?
Was or is, I will check for you. £320 is the price.
Not the one that guy's coming, it's out of Hong Kong by any chance.
I don't know.
So it got a big screen on it?
No screen.
Okay, oh no, there was one that this guy had put together. Oh no, it's not. No. That's not at all the one I was thinking of.
No, pastel colours.
There was one a guy had done with quite a big screen on it, a bit like some of the 1010 stuff, and that was only around about £300 to £400.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a Kickstarter, and I almost went in on it.
Oh. Mm. Doesn't look like this is Kickstarter. I said the wrong things, did I?
Okay.
But I think there was a pre-sale on the website.
Okay.
Out of stock, next run, who knows when. Cool little thing. So check it out. Like I said, I don't think it sounds incredible, but there was only one sound demoed in the demo. We'll find out. This week on Behringer Watch, apparently they're working on a remake of the Pearl Syncussion, which is kind of boring.
What?
It was a percussion synthesizer with a bunch of triggers in and stuff, and it's synth circuits to make sounds. It's awful. I don't know why they're bothering to
Have
do
you
it.
Got a picture of the original,
yes,
by any chance?
Let me show
I've never
you.
Heard of it.
No, that's not the original. Well, their panels often look very similar. So there's their version of it.
Okay.
There's actually a demo of the original on the Synth Anatomy article that I found. It sounds terrible. Don't know why they're bothering. Let's move on from Behringer Watch.
Well, as I say, they seem to be absolutely determined to copy everything that ever existed.
Okay, here's one for you Pure Data nerds out there. Well, Pure Data, Super Collider, or C-Sound nerds. So that'll be music-y audio programming languages. Mm-hmm. There is a company called Bela. Oh, Bela. Bela. Bela.
A company called Bela.
B-E-L-A.
B-E-L-A.
Which is something, well, the Bela, or Bela, their Dubry, is, think, kind of teensy type thing. So, generic computational Raspberry Pi platform type Dubry.
Okay.
And this module called Bela is the Eurorack panel to go with that.
Oh, interesting.
So, the Bela bit that sits on the back will run patches from C-Sound, SuperGlider, PureData, and the Pepper panel and stuff, which you can get as a DIY kit, gives you a bunch of I.O. that you can really easily implement into your modular stuffs. So you get stereo audio in and out, 8 CV inputs, which 4 of which can be triggers as well, 8 offset potentiometers that you could use to control parameters, 8 CV outputs, 4 buttons, 10 LEDs. There's a quick demo there. They've made patches doing a tape delay style thing, wavetable drums, 4-channel looper, vocal synthesis, first principle drum machine, and a dual inharmonic oscillator. But of course, it's all about what you're making in Pure Data Super Collider C-Sound. So if that's your thing, check it out. The Pepper Eurorack module, which will be available as a full kit from Thonk. Lastly, in the Synth News section, the Akai MPC firmware, I guess, because I think they're all on the same firmware, 2.1.
It's certainly the same operating system on all of the units.
So there's an update, 2.10, 2.10, whatever. There's been an update which has leaked hints of an Akai Pro workstation keyboard, which is an interesting idea. Think, just looking at the sort of very vague picture, think MPC Live, add a little bit of Roland Juno DS, and it's a keyboard controller workstation thing, but it's Akai and it's an MPC and it's very strange. That brings us to the end of Synth News. You know what that means when we've got Luke in the house. You know what it means.
Luke's spacey bit.
Is now happening, because I was supposed to say it's time for, because I forgot how the jingle worked. Luke, help me.
That was a lot of synth news. I enjoyed
it.
It
was a lot. Hope it wasn't too boring.
No, not at all. It's fascinating, as always. It's one of those things where I wish I knew a bit more about it so I could participate a bit further. But this is fine. This is what I'm here for.
This is the bit we love. Oh, take it away.
So we are here to talk a little bit about Oumuamua.
A who, a what?
Oumuamua.
Hawaii?
Yeah.
Oh,
actually, good guess. You saw my notes, didn't you?
I didn't, actually. I'm just thinking of the national fish, which has the stupid long name.
It's like that train station in Wales.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Landfare and give up.
Yes. Oh, I didn't know how to say it once. Anyway, so Oumuamua is...
Actually, I have another bit. It's Landfair Puth, and that's all I got.
Are you Welsh?
No.
Okay. So Oumuamua is...
Chop this out, Pete.
Or keep it. It's fine. It's Hawaiian for scout.
Oh, interesting.
Which is quite telling. I think we covered Oumuamua briefly on an older podcast where I compared it a little bit to a classic Arthur C. Clarke story. And I want to say it's Arthur C. Clarke and not Asimov. I'm fairly certain it's Clarke.
Rendezvous with Rama.
Do you know the one?
Yes.
Excellent book. Have you read it?
I've listened to the audiobook.
I read a copy of it once and then had the audiobook afterwards. Enjoy both. So Oumuamua is essentially life imitating art. A extrasolar object has come into our domain and mystified the scientific community. It's a less than a kilometre long, cigar-shaped asteroid object that has entered our solar system, passed by the sun, and skipped out again, much like the opening of Rendezvous with Rama. And of course, when it happened in 2017, much fuss was made about whether or not it was a ship, proof of extraterrestrials at last? Was it just a rock? Was it something in between? Was it derelict? Who knows? The point is that we didn't really have a huge amount of telescope technology to spend a huge amount of time looking at it that was ready and available that could get us the images that we really, really wanted. It was a bit too far away. And one particular scientist is kind of hanging on to the idea that it is a proof of extraterrestrial life, or it could certainly have been, but we'll probably never know now, so we should be ready for the next time this comes around. That's Avi Loeb. He's a Harvard professor of theoretical astrophysics, and he wrote a book about the occurrence of Oumuamua and is now funding, with essentially philanthropic donations, the Galileo Project, which is an organization, a drive to put, or initiative, if you will, to put together and use existing and upcoming telescope technologies to search for and be on the lookout for future iterations of Oumuamua, things that could come forth that are, who knows, possibly proof of extraterrestrial life, possibly just rocks. We won't be able to find out unless we get a close look, but that's the purpose behind this Galileo project. They want to use things like the upcoming Vera Rubin telescope that's being built in Chile. They want to design a launchable craft that could catch up with and perhaps not necessarily approach or touch, although that would be very cool. This is very much a design phase at the moment, but could get a much closer look at these and possibly even sample in a similar vein to OSIRIS-REx and Hayabusa 2, the asteroid rendezvous craft that JAXA and NASA have been running recently, have had great success with meeting up with distant asteroidal objects and bringing back samples and doing sample return missions that have never been done before. So perhaps something like that, perhaps just a visual medium, we're not sure yet. But whether Avi Loeb is right and Oumuamua was something extraterrestrial in terms of a transporter ship, a derelict wreckage or whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's beside the point. The point is that I think this is a good idea. I think that being ready for something the next time it comes around, if it does in our lifetime, in his lifetime or in 100 years, is a good idea, because it would be awesome just to tell us a little bit about stuff that comes from outside our solar system to have be able to get a better picture of these things when they come close to us.
How often do we get any kind of extrasolar object?
I believe this is the only one actually known.
Yeah, this is the only...
Just one, and that's your lot.
The space is extremely big.
So most of the kind of asteroids that we're sort of occasionally see closer to us, were they, I think a couple of weeks ago, you're talking about the...
Kuiper Belt orbit.
Yeah, with the big old elliptical ones.
Yeah.
So that's what we see most of the time.
Yeah, so
okay.
Those elliptical orbits are so massive, when we look at them in their sort of everyday state, they appear to be in a spherical formation around the outside of the solar system because their orbits are so huge, until they dip down, or depends on where they are in their journey. But the orbit that Oumuamua would have would encompass the solar system on part of its leg. That's right. How elliptical that would be. The solar system is just a very small part of its ellipse. So it's come from somewhere else. We don't really know where. And how often is that going to happen? Well, it's kind of like asking how many times, could you hit a very, very small target with a very, very small projectile without really looking at where you're pointing it? And with only throwing one every 1,000 years, who knows? We to answer those questions, we need to have a sample size of more than one. We don't have that at the moment.
But readiness is the name of the game for this kind of thing.
Exactly. Because just like the book Rendezvous with Rama, they essentially have an encounter with a object like a Oumuamua, and they can't make the best of it. And then I think something bad happens in the book. I think there's a meteor.
Spoilers. I might read it.
Oh, it's the first chapter. Honestly.
Okay, that's fine.
this is all set dressing. The rest of the book is fantastic, and it deals principally with the crew that go to visit Rama. They have a close encounter with an asteroid, and they decide to build something like the Galileo Project, sort of readiness. This is obviously before we had so much of the stuff that we have now in terms of asteroid detection and so on. I mean, having just lost Arecibo, that's a great shame. But still, the point is I think Clark was imagining a world in which we were actively defending against, not hostile aliens, but asteroids that couldn't be stopped that might hit Earth. So in his book, they built a detection system to get a better look at this stuff, to get an early warning, and they were able to go and investigate an Oumuamua type object on its way through the solar system. It's a fantastic book, and
I'm down. I really like Arthur C. Clarke. You got it right.
It's a little bit off its time, but it's still a wonderful read because the world in which that he imagines the alien ship to be is just
spoilers.
Again, it's not. I'll do my best to avoid them. I'll describe it as plainly as I can. It's quite a good take. He doesn't try and define it too much, which I really like. So yeah, in this week's space news, life imitates art in the most bizarre way ever, as it often frequently does. So if we want to move on from that, we have a little bit of science fiction news.
The perfect segue.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know what it is?
I do. I watched it, but I'm not enthusiastic, so I think you should enthuse us.
God damn it. You have no taste.
I'll try.
So we have been graced with a follow-up trailer for the new film Dune, which is coming out in October 2021. I think on the 22nd in the UK.
Yes, on my boss's birthday.
Oh, yes. I'm definitely going to be in the cinema. I was tempted. I've never been to an IMAX, but I was tempted.
We're next to an Everyman. That's the only thing that's come out recently or is coming out that I'm like, maybe, maybe.
Certainly looks like quite a spectacle for the eyes.
Now, I like David Lynch, and I'm not going to spend this segment poo-pooing his film, but I didn't like the imagining of Dune that he brought to the franchise
is
in the
80s. Oh, the old one. Yeah, cool.
Is that because you'd already read Dune before you saw it, so you already had a perception of what you expected to see and his interpretation wasn't? I'm not a great reader, being dyslexic, and my first encounter, I was aware of the book, because obviously it's, when was it written, in the 1960s or even before that?
Yes, I think it was published in the 60s, but I think Herbert wrote it in the 50s, yeah.
I wouldn't say it's dated because of the way it's set. Anything in there that would pigeonhole it in a particular period.
It's one of the more philosophical sci-fis, like Clark in that respect. Yes. It doesn't date it
too
hard.
So it works really well. But my first encounter of the actual story in any depth was the David Lynch film.
Right, yeah.
And I'm quite a David Lynch fan. I was really quite into Twin Peaks and some of the other bits and pieces he's done.
Yeah, no, I have no problem with Lynch's body of work. It's just I didn't like the changes he made to the franchise.
Well, I'm not personally aware of what he did to the underlying story to suit his own...
Without going into too many spoilers for those of us who don't know...
I'm still sort of trying to read it.
it's good. I thoroughly recommend the Audible production of the audiobook, if you're keen. There is a bit of a disjointed vibe in that they have a narrator who does the majority of it. It's kind of like a play.
Yeah, there's a few other voice actors involved, aren't there?
And they've cast them really well for the characters, but it is a bit strange.
The few characters I met on my listen to first two or three chapters were good. I couldn't get on with the narrator, so I think I'm going to have to read it.
That's the thing, yeah. I wasn't crazy about the narrator's voices for the characters that weren't when the actors weren't there, which is a bit of a shame. But the music and the production otherwise, I really enjoyed it. So I did get through it, and I would recommend the audiobook as a good place to start.
Yeah.
Because the text is it's a bit of a dry text. It's a philosophical sci-fi. There's not a huge amount of characterization. The book kind of introduces the universe and then fast forwards to we're on Dune. And Dune kind of sucks. That's pretty much how the book goes. So in the film we're going to see a lot more of the backstory of the other characters, the world.
Do you think this particular production, this particular film that's being released now, will be more faithful to the book?
I think so. I mean, I wouldn't...
Or books, I should say.
I don't know how you pronounce his name precisely. It's Villeneuve, Denis Villeneuve, and he's a fantastic...
I quite liked Arrival.
Yeah, and I'm a massive fan of the Blade Runner sequel.
That's the thing. My colleague got the trailer up on the computer at work because he's just obsessed. He can't wait. And he mentioned that it's the same director as Arrival, and that's actually what made me care about it, because Arrival was incredible.
So one of the things that the Lynch version did was he changed a sort of a Jedi mind trick type thing, because Dune predates Star Wars, but George Lucas basically
ripped off everything.
Yeah, kind of.
Star Wars pulls from so much science fiction, just pick and mix.
In Dune, you haven't got space magic as such. It's more about manipulation of people, and it's the book walks the line between it's definitely magic and it's actually subtle political influence and body language and like impression.
I think I got a bit of a taste of that in the first couple of chapters, at least. Even actually, mostly the first chapter, to be honest.
And I think Herbert kind of flirts with this idea that maybe it's all in the character's head. Maybe it is just like subtle and very good, like statescraft and training. Maybe not. But again, that's an argument for a literary discussion about the book. The Lynch version kind of turns all that into a gun that you talk through. Didn't like it, personally. Yeah. I think the upcoming Villeneuve version is going to be really cool, because we're going to see, from what people are saying about this, there was an event just recently where they showed some of the opening parts of the movie. Very brief overview, the family that the main character, Paul, belongs to, the Atreides family, they get sent to Arrakis. They get sent to oversee production of a thing called spice, which is just needed for the Empire to function. And it's kind of mined by this indigenous people called the Fremen. And we don't really have any characterization in the book. It's like I say, it's quite a philosophical text, but the film is going to go into the struggles of the Fremen under their previous masters, how that changes when Paul's house comes in, who are renowned for being fairer. We're going to see, I think, quite a lot of the world that Paul came from, which is described as being this sort of beautiful garden world, with it's very rainy, very mountainous, kind of like, I don't know, a planetary Scotland, I guess.
Planetary Scotland, yeah. Love it.
So we're going to see a lot more world building in this film, which I can't wait for, because I think Dune was crying out for that, the original text. It's a good book, but it needs some characterization, it needs some world building. As if I could critique Herbert, but the point is, I just think it's going to be a really good adaptation.
The hype is real.
Yeah.
It does look very slick.
Mm. And they've got some good actors.
Yes. I have to say that the David Lynch version was a very expensive film for its time to make, production-wise.
To be fair, I really enjoy the look of it. I think the costume design, I think the way it's filmed is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoy it because it's got a sort of, it's got the David Lynch thing about it, and there's certain classic lines, even if it's not sort of sticking to the novel.
Well, a lot of the dialogue does, that's the thing.
I have to say, it was also massively sampled at the beginning of Acid House.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
It's so many people.
Fear is the mind killer.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Or even the Emperor's daughter doing that speech. She does
Princess Erelon, yeah.
And there's two versions of that, because if you go onto YouTube, you can see the long-form version of her speech and the short-form version.
What is that? It's important to place Muad'Dib in the time that he came from, and it's 10,000 years.
Yeah, that's the long form, but she just goes on about the spice in the short one. The spice must flow. And
I think
all that
I've heard songs that have that in it. Yes. The Lynch film is great to do it credit again.
I hadn't realised I know that it's going to be stylized. He's in his sort of genre of filmmaking, but I didn't realise he'd departed that far from the narrative of the book.
It's the bad guy as well. Like, the Harkonnens are supposed to be brutal. They're not good people. But in the book, the Baron is a sort of tortured aristocrat with a really crummy life, and he's ruined by various assassination attempts. His life, his body, his existence, his pain. He's not a happy man, but it's like evil begets evil, but it's not all entirely his fault. He's semi-sympathetic in the book. You can understand how he got there, basically. In the film, he's kind of this clown laughingstock in the Lynch film.
Yeah, he's just horrible.
Cackling evil fiend. Yeah, in the book, he's somewhat, like I say, not sympathetic, but relatable.
So there's shades of grey. This isn't exactly black and white.
You can tell he's kind of a pawn and he knows it, but he doesn't want to be. He has his own plans and so on.
So that the Emperor's machination, to speak.
Yeah, and the Emperor's not a cool dude either, that's the thing. So I'll be excited. So this upcoming Villeneuve film is Dune Part 1, which is going to be like a two-hour film. And we're going to see...
So when you say Part 1, is that going to take us... Is that the first book in one, or have they really split it up?
We don't know where it's going to end. We know it's going to end during the first Dune book, but we don't know where.
It won't come to the end where the... ended.
Yes, it won't. I don't think the first film will complete the plot of the first book. No, we think it's going to be around the time that Paul gets set up as a certain thing somewhere.
Cool.
Okay, so they're really stretching it out then.
Well, like I say, I think they're going to really go into the life on Arrakis before the Atreides arrive, which isn't in the book.
So they think they're going to develop it into a franchise and do all the books.
That's the word. Warner Brothers really wants it to work because they want Villeneuve to have a critical success. For one thing,
and then they can go on and make.
Yeah,
was it three books? I want to say.
There's about 20. I
really?
Think.
Did he go mad?
Well, Frank, I think, wrote three or four, and his son carried on after he died.
I seem to remember, and I know you're saying you don't like David Lynch's interpretation, but Frank Herbert was involved in that film.
I know, which is surprising. Because they did change the sort of Bene Gesserit Jedi stuff into a gun. Bit odd, in my opinion.
Well, there was still some.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I
spooky stuff.
I don't know. I'm just being grumpy, but I can't.
I know what you mean. And it's often the way that if you understand a particular story in a certain way because you've already read the novel or you saw a film and then there's a sequel, then you can be quite often disappointed, especially if you've read a novel first and then you go and see a film, and the trouble is the economies of making a film. You can't exactly do it, so something that might have been narrated before is shown visually, so forth. Anyway, it's changed to the point where your initial anticipation of enjoying something is ruined because it doesn't meet your expectations.
And that's going to be an interesting challenge. I'm glad you mentioned narration, because a big part of Dune's storytelling is internal monologue. Like most of the book is told through what people are thinking about other people thinking.
And in the David Lynch version, there's quite a bit of that, isn't there?
Yeah, and I feel like that's quite... I disagree with this interpretation, but I feel like people think monologuing in a film is quite dated. And I don't mind it at all.
No, if it's relevant to the story, or that's how the story's constructed, that's how it should be.
How do they do it in the original?
Well, literally, people would sit there, their lips not moving. You could hear what they were thinking. Right. They were sort of having a kind of little... Yeah.
Yeah, poor actors having to try and look.
There wasn't too much of it. They could be talking, and then you'd suddenly hear them kind of having a bit of a rationale about what they were saying and who they were talking to.
I don't like this at all. In modern films, there's a lot of stuff where they try and adapt that, but what they do is they put it into a conversation that makes no sense.
Oh, the weird exposition type things.
It's like, hey, did you go and turn on the thing? You know the thing we need to do, the thing that everyone has in this universe, but we'll explain it for the audience's benefit right now? It's like, yes, of course I did. I do that every day because I live in this universe. I hate that. I think that's lazy writing.
I'm glad we've extracted some of your really specific nerdery. It's brilliant.
I believe a lot of that is foisted onto the directors or the people making the film by the film company a lot of the time, but depending on what market they're hoping to sell the film.
Exactly. That was certainly written by committee thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that was certainly the motivation for the original release of Blade Runner, whereby they put a kind of sort of detective narration type thing into it because they felt that a lot of audiences wouldn't get it. And subsequently all the sort of director's cut and the final cut and all the various cuts don't have it.
Yeah, and I think in the example of Blade Runner, I actually don't mind the...
No, I didn't. I didn't find it too distracting, let's put it that way. It was fine. I don't mind any of the cuts.
I like the style of the sequel that Villeneuve did because it is very deadpan. It's kind of like, this is the world. It's all visual. If you want to dig in, you're going to have to dig in.
Well, I remember his description of it when he was... and everyone else was doing the promotional rounds. And he said his explanation was, it's the same world through a different pair of eyes.
Yeah, right.
And it is. Yeah. You know, the aesthetic, you think, yes, I can... Yeah, it's the same world.
Mm.
And yes, it's 30 years later or however long.
Wait, 30 years, yeah.
Exactly 30 years.
2019 was the original. That was what it was meant to be set in.
Yes, and we didn't really have any of that, did we?
No.
It's replicant. Maybe they are here. We don't know.
I mean, plus also, apparently it's very, very expensive to build a building that big.
Yes.
Need a lot of concrete, a lot more than they thought we would need.
You know, obviously they reproduce certain buildings like the Tyrell Corporation building. And I think the police building was at the same. There was things that you could identify. It was so you could see, oh, yeah, that's this. It's a bit like, London as a backdrop. There's London.
Yeah, you'll always see the Westminster and so on.
Yeah, there's Big Ben. There's the London Eye, et cetera, or New York or any other city they choose. So it had that. You knew it was set in the same place. Although it wasn't the Vangelis soundtrack, there was echoes of the Vangelis. They just put sort of hints of it in there without...
Yeah, I think I remember watching something. They tried to use as many old synthesizers as they could for that reason.
The only difference I found is the first Blade Runner, for some reason, is a film that I've watched many times and was rewatchable. The second one, I found it a very difficult film to even attempt watching a second time. It was you watch it once, yes, it's a really good film, really high production values, really great, but it's not one that you can endlessly rewatch. It
might be one that requires the cinema experience for...
Possibly, but I have attempted to rewatch it, and there are some great parts in it, but to watch the whole thing through, I've found difficult, and I found that with some films. You know how it is that some films you can watch it and you can just rewatch them. There's something about them.
Yeah, sure.
And some films, even though they're, as I say, they're fantastic, you can't.
I humbly disagree because I haven't watched it a third time, but the first time I watched it, I didn't really understand the plot. I was too busy taking in the sights and kind of went away like, what
did
happened?
Did you watch it in the cinema first time round?
No, it was on a computer at late night.
Okay.
I probably should have been in bed.
But there's a lot to take in, isn't it? Especially with the amount of expectation. You know, a 35-year gap between, or even more, was it 82?
What, in terms of the...
When it was released.
Oh, the actual real-world release time.
Table. Yeah, I think it's 82.
Yes. And just to bring it back to music briefly, one of the things people have been talking about, people that are pundits that have been to this special event that they just did for the new Dune film, apparently the soundtrack is something else.
Is it Hans Zimmer?
Yeah.
Oh,
and he says that he's done lots of recording human voices and trying to make them sound as artificial as possible in order to achieve weird soundscapes.
No, I've seen both
What, trailers?
I've seen both the trailers.
Yes.
And I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen anything, heard anything soundtracky in the trailers, but sorry, go on, I'm interrupting.
Yeah, just as I say, just the general aesthetic, yeah. It looks like it's a massive spectacle. Mm. And you've brought up to bear all the modern techniques, so I imagine there's real models, CGI, there's everything. You know, it's going to look very slick.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, obviously, the David Lynch one, again, what was that, 84? It looks, although I enjoy the aesthetic and the David Lynch style, it's a bit creaky with the special effects.
Yeah, some things have been transplanted over that are fairly similar. Like, for example, the Atreides are quite militaristic in their style, the uniforms and stuff. Yeah. I'm kind of glad that stayed because I liked that aesthetic. Well, yeah, you've got Oscar Isaacs fresh off of Star Wars. You've got Jason Momoa from Marvel. I don't know Timothée Chalamet from anything. I don't know this. I think she's a singer, Zendaya, who plays Chaney.
Well, she's also in Spider-Man.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm not up on my Marvel.
Is she a singer?
DC. Marvel.
Is that where she comes from?
I don't know.
Well, she's in all the Spider-Man.
Okay, I guess that she's an actor as well then. Okay,
They invariably are, aren't they? Yeah, Does she come from Disney by any chance?
Probably, yes.
They tend to go that Disney that as a child, and then they become a singer, and then they go back into acting.
That would make sense. I had heard that she's a performer, but yeah, that's cool.
I don't know her history at all. I've only ever seen her in Spider-Man.
She seems to be doing a really good job in this film. Her role as Chaney looks awesome. And again, like adding characterization where it wasn't really there in a novel is going to be really cool to see on the screen.
I know that Timothée Chalamet had done a Henry V.
Okay, cool.
Is he the right sort of age for that?
Probably, yeah. That's like a Shakespeare adaptation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So excited to see them. Josh Brolin as well, and many others.
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a few people from Marvel because Baron Harkonnen is the.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah.
Yes, I love him. He's one of my favourites.
So many names and words that I don't understand.
Stellan Skarsgård was, many things, but have you seen Chernobyl?
No.
You should watch Chernobyl.
I should. It's on the Netflix list.
Yeah.
Isn't he in Thor as well?
Pass. That's a Marvel question.
Yeah. I don't know. Could well be.
You're a Marvel fan.
Anyway, listeners.
Yeah, I'm sure he's in the Avengers as well.
If I may. Listeners, do stay tuned. Remember that not even a global pandemic has stopped us from podcasting away. We will most certainly have thoughts. Potentially, even I will have watched it as well by the time it's actually out in the cinemas. There will be Dune, version 2 in the future in an October podcast. So keep tuned on those Spotifys, you can find us everywhere. Your favourite podcasting service, you've managed to find us somehow. What we've got to do is read things that Luke is pointing to me. This is a terrible segue. Luke?
Multimedia recommendations.
Yeah, that's the thing that we do right at the end. Who's got one? I've actually got one prepared. I've been forecasting the potential return to the world of modular synthesizers as I've detoxed from music retail. The seeds of interest and enthusiasm are coming back. Another flagpole, signpost, sign, something, whatever. I'm watching Eurorack-related videos on YouTube again, searching for them. They're calling to me in the night. Anyway, I found a cool channel that I hadn't seen before. Some really nice musiques, ambient stuff mostly. The channel is 23 Hanging Trees.
Hmm.
Some Frap Tools stuff, Chaos Devices, all the big names of the modular world. It's just some really nice, calm stuff. Interesting sound design, great cinematography, as always seems to be the way with these small YouTubers that do ambient stuff with cacti and cats in the way. 23 Hanging Trees. Who's next? Pete, you look ready.
I am ready. This is one of these gentlemen who makes things and makes films about him making things.
There are some of them.
And he makes things with wood, metal.
People do that.
And they're the sort of things that we've talked about often, you know, as you say, the bit of brass, a bit of
still searching for that German word.
Yeah,
we'll find it one day.
Finally tweaked and honed piece of equipment. In fact, he make all his own tools as well in a lot of cases.
I think I know who it is.
So, do you think you did it before?
I don't think I did, but is his name Chris?
No.
No.
Okay. This guy is called Yuri Tuchman.
No.
Or I was pronouncing it again. This guy is called Yuri Tuchman.
Who knows?
And I thought he was actually French by his accent, but I believe he lives in Germany and he basically makes all sorts of things. There doesn't seem to be any particular theme, apart from these things are heavily engineered, and there's an awful lot of filing that happens.
Oh, yeah.
But the videos are cut so well that it's all... It's not speeded up, but there's only very short snaps of him doing various bits and pieces. So as he's doing something, it's actually watchable. It's not just someone just sitting there filing. Although that could, you know, be some sort of... I can never pronounce it. AMSR?
ASMR.
ASMR.
So, auto-sensory meridian response or something weird like that.
Sounds like it.
That sounds funny.
He's got a small... lathe, which he built, and then a year later he built another lathe.
Wait, he like designed and built his own
lathe.
What a guy. I just found one of his videos making an unnecessarily complex mechanical pencil, and I think I'm on board.
Yes. I mean, all sorts of wonderful things. As I say, he makes all the tools, but then he'll make other things with the tools that he makes with the tools that he makes.
He's so many levels deep.
But some of the other ones, there was one that he makes, and it was a wooden tapping finger. I don't know what purpose it actually had. It was like a mechanical, like some sort of automaton.
Maybe it's like, you know, those sort of Japanese Zen garden bamboo fountain things that make that... bonk noise every so often.
But everything is stylized. Even if he makes a hammer, it's stylized.
Yeah,
so
cool.
So I've had watched him. There's one where he's making an astrolathe.
Amazing. Yeah. He sounds absolutely mad.
Again, it's one of those examples of someone, it's always very sort of almost relaxing watching someone doing something exceedingly well.
He absolutely looks like the right kind of guy. I thought you were going to recommend Clickspring. Do you know Clickspring?
Yes, you did Clickspring.
Did I? Yeah. Gotcha. Actually looks, because Clickspring really hasn't uploaded anything for ages, so this might just fill the need.
I think it will, because there is a lot of videos on here. He's been on since 2011, so 10 years of this, and I'm just flicking through the video and there's loads of it. So there you go. He makes a sort of sledgehammer and then he engraves it so it almost looks like Milmir.
Yeah, I think I know what my evening's gonna entail.
Sorry, I do apologize for setting you up for that one.
Not at all. Yes. there's his sledgehammer.
Oh yes, very lucky. Mjolnir.
So that was my this week's recommendation, Yuri Tuchman.
He's got
and
a
that's
hand.
Spelled
sorry
he's for got those a... who require it. That's spelled URITUCHMAN.
Nice,
Yuri Tuchman.
Sorry, I was laughing. I came across the thumbnail for his hand cranked circular saw. It looks absolutely lethal. That's really cool.
That's fantastic.
Love it. Right, Luke. Take us away to the end of the show.
A simple, quick one from me. This is an album called Munj. That's M-A-N-J. Munj.
Careful how Munj. You pronounce it.
That's true.
Munj.
Munj. By the band Jumanji, which is J-O-O-M-A-N-J-I. Jumanji is a six-piece band. The drummer, Amir Usman, is just absolutely fantastic. It's a swung kind of rap album, very ambient, very decent hip-hop, basically. It's absolutely brilliant. Standout song for me is Around the World, which features guest singers. I think it's Yasmin Lacey, but she certainly features on the album and other places as well. The drum beat is so pushed you could lean on it sideways.
Oh, yeah.
It's fantastic. It starts off with a piano comes and you're like, okay, I can count this. It's one, two, hang on. How are they playing that in time? It's fantastic. So that's Munj by Jumanji. Every song on the album is an absolute treat for the ears, especially if you're into your lazy beats, Jay Dilla, Questlove, that kind of stuff. It's really, really good. That's Jumanji.
Excellent. As always, listeners, thank you for listening, because that's what listeners do. Amazing. What an outro. Thank you. We'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.